Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, everybody. So today, I'm going to tell you a little bit about yesterday. I went down to Alberton to visit my good friend from the University of Montana, Kavita, from Hindu Hillbilly Farms and Rivulet Apiaries. And I found out what Rivulet Apiaries is because that's kind of where she lives. And I was going to get a hive of new bees for Mike. I'm so excited. They're like the prettiest little bees. They're like the color of dandelions. They're just this really pretty yellow, and they made it home safely. It was a giant adventure. But while I was on my way down there, I was listening to Anastasia Cole Plekaeus' book, The Farm on the Roof, the Audible version. And I know, you know, I'm totally fascinated with this book right now, but she talks about Richard Wiswall's book, The Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, and how much it helped them with their accounting. And that's really what I want to talk about today. And I wanted to give you a little bit of backstory with my experience with Richard's book. So a few years ago, back in 2012, I was teaching and I met this amazing woman, Dr. Molly Blakely, who has developed the reading curriculum we're using at our school. And I was just totally enamored with her, confidence, her knowledge. She just seemed so amazing to me. And when she told me she went to Columbia University in New York City, I was just inspired, and I had found a master's degree in communications there that I thought totally fit my personality to a T. It was going to enable me to combine my love of technology and my writing skills and go spend some time with my family, because at the time my dad was still alive and I knew they were getting, you know, my nieces were growing up and I didn't hardly feel like they even knew who I was. You know, my youngest niece is like, Aunt Jackie, who's Aunt Jackie? And so I just, you know, it just seemed like a good fit. And so I applied and actually got accepted. So anyway, long story short, so I set about trying to find a place on Long Island or maybe New Jersey, just someplace not far from the city that maybe Mike could work as a farm manager or something. And we could start like a little organic farming business while I went to school there. And of course, I was thinking I would promote the business, learn about it. And anyway, I just thought it would be a really good fit for us. So I had just read Lynn Bazinski's The Flower Farmer book, and I had just read Richard's Business Handbook, Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, and thought, you know, maybe we could sell. In New York, there's like all these little street corner markets, and almost every one of them has buckets of flowers there. I mean, you really don't walk by a corner in New York City without being able to buy a bucket of flowers, I think, every few blocks. And so I thought, you know, but I've never seen organic flowers there. You know, maybe things have changed. I've been in New York. Last time I really lived and worked there was in 2009, 2010. That's not that long ago. Anyway, I thought, you know, that would be perfect. You know, if we could be selling some flowers in their stands, maybe some vegetables too, I wasn't really sure. And I still think somebody could have a good business just supplying the area right around Columbia University in New York City. And New Jersey happens to have this awesome website. I want to say it's through the National Historic New Jersey Historic Preservation site. But anyway, where you can connect with landowners who are looking for someone to either lease or manage or rent some farmland and grow food. And I'll put the link to the show notes. It's still there. It's a great website. I have been like checking it all the time. And so I thought I found this perfect farm. It came with a nice little home to live on. It was backed up against this thriving elementary school. You know, I'm picturing giving farm tours and just like this whole thing. The guy really liked Mike. And so he was like, we'll come up with a business plan. So I dove into Richard's book. I started creating this business plan. He's got like these amazing worksheets, spreadsheets, crop journals, marketing charts, seedling calendars. They're just all remarkable. He totally explains how to figure out the cost of labor, equipment, you know, right down to like how many hours it's going to take to, you know, irrigate, to cultivate, to weed, to harvest, to wash and pack, to market, like each individual product. And you like do it per acre, and you can like figure out your whole thing. You can create these simple crop budgets, and then you can analyze, and this is a key, which crops are truly profitable and which ones are not. And he also really goes into being efficient and how to get the most produce for your labor. So Even though I was able to create a viable business plan, unfortunately, one, the farm just seemed way too far away from New York City. It was like over 80 miles. And I was like, I'm not going to see my family any more than I already do here in Montana. Plus, the cost of going to Columbia for my master's proved to be prohibitive, which might be a blessing in disguise because I may never have started the Organic Gardener podcast if I had gone there. So who knows? Anyway, this is probably a long story into today's interview, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to replay my interview with Richard from back in November, because I think it really has some great content there. It's a really good time to hear it right now as spring is coming on. It talks a lot about growing tomatoes that I think listeners are going to like. And according to Google Analytics, he has one of the most viewed pages on my website of all time. So I hope you like it as much as I do. I always think it's good. I go back and listen to podcasts over. So, you know, maybe if you're a new listener and you haven't heard this one, it's a great episode to listen to. And if you've heard it before, I think you'll probably enjoy hearing it again. So thank you always so much for listening. And so here is my interview with Richard Riswell from back in November. Welcome to today's episode of the Organic Gardener podcast. I am thrilled to introduce my guest today, who has written an amazing book that I think will inspire listeners to think about different options for their future. His book starts out piquing your interest with a quote from a talk that a fellow farmer gave at a New England vegetable and fruit conference. And this fellow farmer said, "Sometimes I think I should have listened to my parents and become a doctor or lawyer, but you know, I didn't think I could take the pay cut." And eventually my guest would write the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, a complete guide to managing finances, crops, and staff, and making a profit. This book comes with a companion CD that includes awesome templates. I've checked these out. I've used them myself before when trying to create a business plan. And the templates are for creating worksheets, budgets, including cash flow projections, and even payroll. And as manager of the Kate Farm, which is a family-owned and operated organic farm in central Vermont that includes 22 acres and 700-foot-long greenhouses of organic vegetables, medicinal herbs, and flowers, everything they sell is certified organic. So here today to dazzle you and teach you some cool things is Richard Riswell. So welcome to the show, Richard.
Well, thank you, Jackie. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, so I give you one of the longest introductions I've given yet. So do you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I've been farming full-time for about 35 years now. And, you know, business has changed over the years, but generally, you know, for the first 20 years, I was in kind of a very highly diversified organic vegetable, herb, flower producer that sold to markets in central Vermont, as well as through a Deep Root Organic Truck Farmers Co-op, which is a growers co-op that sells to Boston and New York, to bigger stores. And we had a CSA in the 90s. I went to farmers market for 25 years. And as I get older, I just don't want to work as hard as I used to. And so we no longer go to the farmers market, no longer do the CSA, even though I'm big fans of both of them. So, you know, generally what the other thing I've been doing, besides farming is to help other farmers trying to help tune up their businesses, because I see a lot of people starting out or kind of after, you know, 5 or 10 years feeling a struggle of being able not to make enough money, and they are working long hours and burning out basically because their money's not there for, the amount of the work they put into it. And so I would help other farmers through workshops at conferences, and then I wrote this book because I kind of saw the same things that came up over and over again that seemed to be, a point needing to be addressed. And so, in short, you know, I think farmers, you know, and gardeners love doing what they do for all the right reasons of being outside and watching plants grow and nurturing them and producing delicious, nutritious food. I mean, really, what could be better? I mean, it's a fundamental satisfaction from all that. But, you know, I don't think anybody gets into farming because they want to be a business person or study balance sheets or cash flow projections. But ultimately, we all have to do that just because we have to survive as a business. So the reality is that farming and market gardening are, if you want to make a living from it, a business, and you have to know the business end of it or you're not going to succeed. And it's, you know, you can be as ecologically sustainable as possible, but if you're not economically sustainable, that goes out the window because you won't be in business anymore. So I just try to get folks to spend a little time to work on their business, not just in their business, and, you know, actually, you know, take some time out during the week, set aside 3 hours to do some long-range thinking and planning and look at the business and also analyze where the money comes and goes. So then you can work fewer hours and make more money. I mean, ultimately, that would be great. I think what a lot of people want, but I think farmers tend to overwork themselves, and farmers can be very guilty of self-exploitation because they believe so strongly in what they do, and for good reason, because it's a great way of life, that you can work longer and longer hours and sacrifice a lot of other parts of your life in order to make your farm succeed. But that self-exploitation has a boundary at some point where you just can't do that as much anymore, and you won't be able to keep going it, or you burn out. So that's, you know, that's where I'm coming from, and that's where, you know, I like to point people, is just to say, hey, you know, if you're going to try to make a living farming or market gardening, pay attention to the business end. Was that a very long-winded answer to your question, Jackie?
No, that okay. was perfect. I think a lot of people are going to like to hear that, that there are options. Because actually, I was in a Facebook group the other day, and this guy was saying, oh, you can't get into farming unless you have, you know, huge amounts of acreage and there's no money to be made and it's really a struggle. And so I think people are going to be excited to hear that if you, you know, pay a little attention to business. And certainly all of my podcasting friends talk about this a lot. You know, they're always like, if your podcast isn't making money, then it's a hobby. It's not a business. You know, you need to think about, you know, how, no matter how much you want to follow your passions, you know, you have to be a realist. And as an artist, because my husband's really more the gardener and I'm more the artist in the family, you know, there are lessons I need to learn too. So I think people are going to be excited to hear a lot of what you have to say. And, you know, no matter how much we all like to do what we like to do, there's always that piece about how you're going to make money about it.
It's interesting you bring up, you know, how people say, oh, it's hard to do. It's, you know, there's a lot of barriers involved. And that's true. And I don't want to sugarcoat the fact that farming is a hard way to make a living. But, you know, that kind of naysayer attitude is one that is self-fulfilling. And I'm not sure if it's a genetic defect of farmers that tend to kind of moan more than look on the bright side. But I think what you hear in the farming community is that a lot more people are maybe complaining about all the things that can go wrong, whether markets, pest disease, you know, tractor breaks down, whatever it might be. And you hear very little from the people that are successful. And there's a reason for that, too. I think the people that are successful don't like, you know, they don't like to brag about their success. And so you don't hear from them. All you hear are the voices of saying, oh, no, you can't make a living farming. And, you know, that's an easy mm-hmm. course to teach. You know, if you say, I can't make a living farming, I said, okay, well, you just taught yourself. And, you know, the more you think that, the more it's going to become true. And great, you've achieved your goal, which is you're not going to make a living farming. And as opposed to saying, no, and I believe very strongly, I'm very bullish about farming, that a good living can be made farming, and that you just have to think about it and, you know, treat it as more as a business as opposed to just something that will fall into your lap.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One thing that has kind of been a theme on my show, as people have talked about their, you know, I kind of go through what grew well this year and then what are you going to do different, you know, what was challenging, is that even if one thing fails, the majority of what you do works. So that one little failure you're going to learn from, and maybe things didn't go the way you want, and every year you're going to have something, but the majority of things work. So that's been kind of nice. And so I think you're going to be really optimistic about the part about actually making a business out of your garden. But before we do go a little too much further, I do always like to start the show asking people about your very first gardening experience. You know, like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? Who were you with? Like, can you remember, like, your very first gardening experience?
Sure. My parents kept a garden all as a kid, all through my childhood. And my first gardening experience was me and my brother, who was 2 years older than me, going out there. And I don't think we were actually hired. I think we were just asked to do it. And we were asked to flip a new piece of ground. And so we both took some spades and we were just sitting there for an hour or so turning over sod and then kind of hoeing it into shape. That's in a very fond memory of that. Kind of that there's satisfaction in kind of working with the earth. And after that, my parents would have a garden. We'd help tend the garden. But my actual first solo garden was probably when I was 19 and I was working at a summer camp and had the opportunity to have a garden plot in a kind of this community garden there. And actually, you know, that's, I think, the steep learning curve where you realize, oh, you have to, you know, try putting in some peppers, what kind of peppers you're going to grow, what's the spacing, you know, what kind of fertility, you get cutworms, what do you do about cutworms, and, you know, all those kind of things. And that was a really positive thing. It was, and plus the fact that all the neighbors and fellow employees were so willing to help share their knowledge about how to do things. And that's, I think, part of the gardening community, is that everyone is willing to help one another out to for everyone's success. And that's a very positive thing. It wasn't till I actually came to Kate Farm and tilled up an acre. So I started out small. We had an acre, had someone custom till up an acre, and we planted a very highly diverse kind of a shotgun approach of, you know, what would do well and what would sell well. We planted an acre, and then after the next year we did 2 acres, 4 acres, 6 acres, 8 acres, up to 16 acres. And so we quickly went up to scale and then actually back down to about 12 because I felt like 12 of highly diverse row crops is about all that I wanted to handle with the crew that we had. So, you know, that's my first gardening experience. And it kind of just, you know, I think as a kid, I always grew up wanting to be a homesteader. Me and my brother, you know, would go and read Mother Earth News from issue one. We'd like be totally into the self-sufficiency and independent living skills. And, you know, thinking that, well, I'd do, you know, maybe back then I thought, as a kid, I thought, well, I'd be, you know, half-time farmer, half-time professional. But then turns out I became a full-time farmer pretty quick. And luckily, happily so.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Vermont, right?
No, I didn't. Actually, I grew up in Long Island, about halfway out on the South Shore, which was very agricultural. I grew up around, you know, potato, cabbage farms surrounding me, even though my family wasn't, they weren't farmers, but surrounded by farmers. Since then, it's changed and it's kind of grown up to houses and woods. But Long Island was a beautiful place to grow up in the 50s and 60s. And then I moved to Vermont when I went to college. So when I was 17, I moved to Vermont and I've been here since then.
Okay. I grew up on Long Island too. So my family's still there. And it is beautiful. Like, people are always surprised, but actually Long Island's got, you know, lots of nature preserves, and out on the East End, there's certainly lots of farms and cool places that you can visit. So people are always surprised that there's nature walks and things on Long Island and trees. Yeah.
Once you get past the commuting line, like, you know, maybe halfway up from the island, well, it does become agricultural. And the eastern end is very nice agricultural soils, and almost had the North Fork's got almost like a New England feel with the architecture and look to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, like, what organic gardening or friendly gardening means to you?
Sure. The, you know, I think I was attracted to organic farming, well, besides reading all the Mother Earth News way back when. I went to school, and during my junior year, I went to Nepal and lived with a farm family for 3 months in outside of the Kathmandu Valley, and living in a kind of a mud hut, and, you know, they kept water buffalo and raised all their own food, and subsistence level farming, and then we'd bike in to school for language and culture classes. And that was a real pivotal point of my life. And, you know, and that was kind of, and then I did a independent project when I was in Nepal on the effects of the Green Revolution. And so that kind of started, you know, making me think along the lines of wanting to run my own farm. And then I came back to college, and Helena Scott Nearing came to talk, and I read books like Diet for a Small Planet and Radical Agriculture, and Wendell Berry's Unsettling of America kind of capped it all. But it was my college advisor who put me on a tractor one weekend to help him out disc a field, and that was when I realized that that's what I want to be doing. So that's kind of, you know, how I kind of started doing it. I forget, could you restate your question there, please, Jackie?
I just said, like, what does organic gardening organic gardening mean to you?
Okay, so what does organic gardening mean to me is kind of living by a set of value, or, you know, for me, being an organic farmer, I like having a business that doesn't compromise any of my values for a healthy planet and treating people well and producing nutritious food. I think it's the greatest thing in the world. It is the greatest job in the world. And so what it means to me is to use nature's cycles to produce a nutritious food without any undue impact or harmful impact. And so for me, it's, you know, using as much that's given to us, whether it's sunlight, atmospheric nitrogen, carbon, incredibly diverse microbial complex soil, and interrelationships that we can use to grow good food for plants and animals, plants and animals. And so to me, you know, organic gardening is, I mean, on a very technical level, you know, we're certified organic, and so we have a federal law that says what's organic and what's not. But, you know, in a more general sense, it's more of using those natural cycles, nutrient cycling as much as possible, and treating the soil with utmost respect, so you're encouraging it as opposed to, you know, depleting it or mining it. So on a practical level, you know, we use a lot of cover crops. So we have the ability, because we have more acreage than available to us than we actually row crop, that we can rotate things in and out of cover crops. And I eventually got a combine so we could actually grow grains and combine those off as part of our rotations. But generally, if we grow cover crops, we're basically growing a crop that is, you know, resting the soil from row crops, as well as increasing its biological activity and increasing its organic matter by just plowing the crop back into the ground.
Okay.
So that's a kind of a basis of fertility, but we also use a lot of composts and rock minerals depending on the soil test. And so we depend on soil tests quite a bit to see what rock minerals, whether it's, you know, rock phosphate or green sand or lime, that we can put on our soils to achieve the balance that we're looking for.
Okay. There's a lot there. Do you want to tell listeners like what a cover crop is in case they don't know? I know
Sure.
Of my guests have talked about it, but maybe, you know, if they're new to the show or something, just really quickly.
Sure. So a cover crop is any kind of crop that you put on the ground that might not be for consumption, meaning that, I mean, it could be, so if you have a bare ground that you're not going to use next year, say, you could seed a cover crop could be anything from oats to rye to a mix of grasses to peas to radishes to anything that basically helps contribute organic matter, shade out weeds, and then we'll get tilled back in to basically feed the microbes in the soil, so that in the future you can then plant your garden with very little extra inputs. And so, yeah, cover crops can come all different forms. And cover crops, some are nitrogen fixing, the legumes, you know, peas, beans, alfalfa, clovers. And then some are used for kind of smothering out weeds that kind of grow close together and shade out all the other weeds, things like oats, rye, buckwheat. And so, you know, you can do mixes and, you know, it's kind of fun to try different things. Some are cold hardy, some are not cold hardy. And, you know, as a gardener, you know, in the fall, once you get everything out of the ground, it's nice to sow just some oats. You can just get some, you know, oat feed from the feed store and sprinkle it on your ground. It'll pop right up and then they'll grow a few inches. And then depending where you are in the United States, but they'll winter kill, you know, in the north. And then next year you can just quickly till that, the dead oat straw into the soil and build your soil that way. So it protects your soil. It increases your soil biological activity. It adds carbon, all good things.
Cool. Okay. That was a nice, long, detailed answer. I like that. Do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Well, this year we actually had a very challenging spring weather-wise. And right now we have a lot of cover crops in the ground. And as I mentioned before, as I get older, I don't want to work so hard. So we're doing less row crops and more greenhouse crops. And so the greenhouse crops are kind of insulated from bad weather. So, you know, of the greenhouse crops, we have 7 greenhouses that we grow some seedlings for sale for other people, like 6-packs of, you know, tomatoes and broccoli kind of thing. And then we have a couple of greenhouses that we grow tomatoes in the ground, and we graft our tomatoes. I can talk about that later if people are interested.
Okay, yeah.
And then we also have other greenhouses we rotate out of tomatoes that we grow, you know, greens, you know, lettuce and beets and other, you know, things in the ground that we harvest for sale. So in terms of how did the season go outside, it was okay. We actually had a partial crop loss due to weather, and that's just you roll with the punches. And in the greenhouses, everything is fine because we can control the heat because we have these roll-up sides that can go up and down, so we can lower them when it's cold. And we have drip irrigation so we can add water when we need it. And, of course, the top of the greenhouse, even when it's open, is like a big umbrella, so we can control the, you know, those are big factors in terms of getting a crop, is provide the right growing conditions. And so
do you keep the greenhouses going through the winter then?
So no, in Vermont, you can. Our markets are much more spring and summer and fall oriented, but in the winter time, at least where we are, at 44 degrees north latitude, that you don't have enough photo period. The days are too short from, you know, somewhere end of November, beginning of December until the first week of February. And so basically nothing will grow without lights, without supplemental lighting. And so what you can do is you can actually start some spinach in September, say, and let it get up to be almost full size. And then as it gets colder, even without the heat on, it'll just be like having a refrigerator full of spinach. Then on a sunny day when it warms up, you can go cut it and sell it. And then it can freeze solid and no big deal. And then come springtime, so that February 15th window, all of a sudden it'll start regrowing. So if you cut it all, you know, during the winter, it'll actually sprout up again and get another crop off by, you know, end of March. So we do that with spinach, but generally we like to freeze our greenhouses to kill pests and diseases. So we let them get 20 below zero and we drain the water, but we let them get really cold just to help control pests and disease.
Cool. Okay. I think the listeners will like that because I think like when I first asked, I was wondering, I was like, oh man, did they keep their greenhouses going all winter? Is that part of your secret?
Some people in Vermont do, and for certain things, and there's a tomato grower that does that as well. But no, generally, the other thing is, like, I don't like using fuel to heat our greenhouses any more than we have to. And I used to make biodiesel for all the for the greenhouse. I used to take old French fry oil and make biodiesel, and then heat all our greenhouses with a homemade biodiesel. But for other reasons, I'm not doing that any longer. And So we tend to just to heat our greenhouses later in the spring and then not at all in the fall. So we're just using less fuel. But, you know, I did want to say, if there's time, just to talk about greenhouse tomatoes, if for any gardener of any scale, if you're having problems growing tomatoes with early blight or other leaf diseases, that a simple unheated greenhouse makes your job so much easier, because what you can do is you can actually prevent rain from falling on the leaves, which get the surfaces. If you can keep the leaf surface dry, then you eliminated 95% of any problem, because they can't colonize bacteria and fungi on it. And so if you can have a, you know, a covering over it with roll-up sides that you can lower it to keep it on cool nights to keep it extra warmth, you can produce, you know, fantastic tomatoes that taste great and that look perfect, like those catalog pictures. And simply by what we do is we trellis them, so we actually drop strings down from the greenhouse structure until they're about 8 feet tall. And so we just have these, like, it looks like a hedgerow when you walk into the greenhouse, these five rows that are, you know, 10 feet tall, 8 feet tall, you know, loaded with tomatoes. And so, you know, and again, it's not hard to do, but you do have to have some kind of greenhouse structure. But even on a small scale, it's a proven winner. And, you know, almost every professional grower that I know relies on greenhouse tomatoes and not field tomatoes. I mean, they do sometimes grow field tomatoes, but it's so much better to grow them in greenhouses. And I think, unfortunately, maybe listeners are reacting, saying, oh, greenhouse tomatoes don't taste that good, but they get a bad rap from other kind of commercial growers. But a greenhouse tomato actually tastes better than a homegrown outside tomato, because you're actually providing everything that it likes. You're providing warmer nights, you're providing even irrigation through drip lines, you're providing higher fertility and better management. It's everything a tomato wants, and hence they taste better. And you can grow different, you know, any variety in a greenhouse, but you can also grow these incredibly good tasting ones that, you know, will be producing right up through, you know, a hard freeze outside.
Nice. Do you have raised beds in the greenhouse, or they're in the ground in the greenhouse? Or what,
so they're
in
the.
In?
So basically, when I talk about a greenhouse, you know, these are metal hoop kind of, you know, gable pitched roof, metal, metal pipe frames with covering of plastic, usually one or two layers of plastic, of greenhouse, special greenhouse poly that lasts 5 or 6 years. And so we basically, you can just take regular garden soil and put a greenhouse over it by putting these posts in the ground and covering it with plastic. And so what we do is we'll do that. We'll have a greenhouse and we will add compost and rock powders and then till the beds up. And then we make kind of small raised beds, but not like dramatically. And then lay drip lines and then put a mulch on top of the drip lines and then plant through the mulch, tomatoes through the mulch. And from there, we drop strings from the ceiling, and they climb up like Jack and the Beanstalk.
Okay, so I have two questions. So when you said you plant, you don't put the seeds in the ground, though. You're putting starts, that maybe seeds you started somewhere? Or
that's
seeds
correct.
Strictly?
So basically, we will start our tomatoes in a flat and grow them up to about 8 inches tall or something like that, and then bring them into the greenhouse to grow in the ground for so the rest of their life until they set red fruit and get pulled out later in November.
Okay. And then, so when do you start the seeds, and then when do you transplant them into the greenhouse?
So a tomato plant, from the time that you take a seed to the time you want to transplant it into the ground to its permanent resting spot, you know, you're talking 6 weeks or 8 weeks, somewhere in there. And then from there, you put them in the ground. So basically, we'll start seeds inside under lights in February, and then we'll transplant them in late March into a greenhouse, say April 1st here. And then from April 1st, it'll probably be another 60 days before we start getting red fruit. It takes about 60 days for an open yellow tomato flower to set red fruit, depending on variety, obviously. But just to give you a sense of that, 2 months from that. And so basically we'll start having red fruit in the greenhouse end of June, July 1st, somewhere in there. And then the nice thing about that is, A, you're not competing with every other home gardener who won't have tomatoes until the middle of August. Yeah. And so people, you know, there's market demand, which is nice. And besides that, they taste great. then what we'll do is we'll keep growing the tomatoes in the ground. Because it takes 60 days from flower to red fruit, you know, around September 1st, we'll go and top all the plants. Basically, without getting too complicated about the biology of a tomato plant, we can if you top the plant and stop its growth of any new fruit, then you're channeling all the energy into the existing fruit. And so then you'll have more productive fruit before you end up pulling the plants out when it's too cold, say November 1st. That's our mark. So basically, when it gets November 1st, it gets too cold to be really growing tomatoes without extra heat. And that's when we pull them out. So that's why on September 1st, we top them and just let no new flowers emerge. And all we're trying to do is channel the growth into the existing fruit that's on the plant already. Does that make sense?
It does. Your okay. Season must be way different than ours. By September, we're looking at frosts already.
We are too. And so, but we're getting frost. But if you have that layer of plastic and you have the ability to roll down the sides, you can go to my website, and I think there's some pictures in the photo gallery of roll-up sides where you can see, you know, the all the sidewalls just raise up and down 4 or 5 feet, so you get the cross breeze going through there. But then at night, we can roll them down, and so they retain the heat. And so even if it is 27, 26 degrees outside, if you have that layer of plastic with the mass inside of heat, it will not freeze inside the greenhouse. So that's without any supplemental heat. And then if you wanted to, you could actually just take your barbecue grill, turn it on, and leave it in there overnight, and that would give enough heat to keep it from freezing.
Wow, okay. I don't know, it still seems fast for growing tomatoes. 60 days and you're getting fruit. So then do you plant them in a succession so that you're getting fruit? If you're getting fruit in June, you must put some in later so that you're getting them throughout the summer.
That's a great...
Or do they just keep producing? Or
they do keep producing. That's a great observation. And one that... so basically, there's a bell curve of production on tomatoes and most plants, you know, whether they're beans or peas. You know, they kind of start out light, and then in the middle of production, you get tons of fruit, and then at the end, they kind of slow down a little bit again as they senesce. So we do is we do three different plantings. So we do an early planting, and then wait 2 weeks. Do another another transplanting, and then another 2 weeks, and do another transplanting. So that way, they're not all planted once, all coming up at once. We have it, it evens out that bell curve effect. But a tomato will grow, well, if you were to heat it all winter and had supplemental lights, it'll grow year round. And you can grow one plant 100 feet long if you were to keep, you know, pruning off the leaves and just letting that growing tip have place to grow. You could either grow it 100 feet straight up, but most, I don't know anybody does that. You can also grow it sideways, and so you can grow it sideways 90 feet and 10 feet up just at the growing tip. And that's, you know, that's commonly done. Not commonly, but it is done to maximize production for that.
Oh, okay. All right, so I just got to clarify just a couple more things. So you're doing three plantings, weeding 2 weeks, but like... So let's say you're going to plant 10 varieties of tomatoes. Do you like, so you transplant the first 10 varieties, or do you plant like a certain variety and then 2 weeks later you plant a different variety and then 2 weeks later a different variety, or all 10 varieties go in the first day and 2 weeks later all 10 more? And then do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call them waves. And so the first wave will be all 10 varieties of, you know, one third of the total year's worth. And then the second wave will be the same mirror image of that. So you're always getting, okay. You know, each variety spread out over the course of the over the course of the season.
Okay.
Cool. And the other thing I wanted to point out is we do graft our tomatoes, and I encourage people to play around with this because it's pretty exciting. It sounds kind of crazy, but people have been grafting apple trees for a long time, and they've actually been grafting plants in Asia since the early 1900s because they have more pressures on space and producing food. So grafting tomatoes is pretty much just the way it sounds. Like what we do is we'll grow a side by side. We put one seed or have one tray of a rootstock and one tray of the top good tasting tomato that we want. And we grow them side by side until they're maybe 3 or 4 inches tall. Maybe the stem is the diameter of a toothpick or a thick matchstick kind of thing. And then you kind of make a bias cut in each of them and kind of fuse the stems together. And then once they fuse, you cut the top off the rootstock and keep the top of the good tasting tomato. And so we can do that because these rootstocks are such vigorous growers. I mean, it's just unbelievable how vigorous they are. You end up getting not only earlier fruit, but twice the production of the tomato that if you didn't graft it. And we've done this side by side a number of times where we put, we grow this one variety called Buffalo, which unfortunately you can't get anymore, but we bought 5 years worth of seed and put it in our freezer. But so we grow Buffalo on the rootstock of Maxifort, and you know, we do side by side, and you know, they start out about the same, but then all of a sudden it's like the horse race going crazy. So basically, you know, one plant will be 8 feet tall and the other one will be about 3 or 4 feet tall. And so we've gone to grafting all our tomatoes now. And certain people even graft other things too. You can Google it. You know, you can graft cucumbers, you can graft winter squash, and all sorts of fun stuff. And you know, the thing is, you have to buy 2 seeds in order to get 1 plant, but because that plant produces twice as much, you have to put out half as many plants in the end. So it's kind of a wash.
And so my guest number 100 was Bill McDorman, who talked about saving seeds. And he talks about how many seeds you get from a tomato. So it seems like if you're saving your seeds, you'd have 2 seeds. I mean, he said the big problem a lot of people are getting is, what do I do with all these seeds anyway? So if you start saving your own seeds, that would be a problem.
That wouldn't be a problem if you're growing open pollinated tomatoes. And so I'm sure that's what he was talking about, was, you know, saving open pollinated, which are true to type, whereas the one variety that we really like is a hybrid, so we actually have to start with a seed not from our own source, but from the company that protects its parentage. So, but yeah, so that's true. I mean, I guess, you know, we do save our own seed on a few things that are easier to do. But because of tomatoes, you don't have to isolate so much, but certain things you have to isolate quite a bit and worry about cross-pollination from either insects or wind. So we don't try to save all our seeds, but I think it's great to try to do that. And you can also do some of your own breeding, too.
Okay. There was something else I was going to ask you. Oh, can you explain what rootstock is?
So, yeah, rootstock is just a hardier type of tomato. It's a tomato that, you know, if you were to grow it out, you know, wouldn't taste good at all to, you know, but the plant itself is, it grows like a weed. And so they have different varieties of rootstock, Maxifort, Estimo, Beaufort. And you can go, like if you were to go to Johnny's, I don't know if you get a Johnny's selected seed catalog where you are, but they're a great company out of Maine. And they have these tutorials online. You can go there and see how to graft. And they kind of explain it. So it's a good way of getting the visuals of what is actually happening. But you can use, generally when you get a rootstock, it's just a type of tomato that is a very vigorous growing tomato. And then you graft onto the top of that the variety that you want to grow that might not be as vigorous a grower.
Cool. Okay. Is there something you're going to do different next year that you're excited to try? I know you're kind of like on the other end of the spectrum getting ready to retire, but...
Well, we always, my wife actually is the one who does the seedling, you know, the seedlings that we sell to the general public. And she is always trying new things that I've never even heard of. And so it's always fun. So we'll, you know, we'll be selling things that I haven't ever grown, but are always kind of fun. But that's her department. And we're going to be pretty much right now, you know, partly because I've been doing it for 35 years, you know, we've kind of reached cruising altitude and, you know, we can, you know, go along at cruising altitude without and tweaking things as we go, but not take huge monumental changes. And that's kind of what we'll keep doing. And except for the, you know, the varieties that we're doing, and that Sally, my wife, is doing in the greenhouse that are always new and different. We'll probably be keeping doing the same basic farm plan that we've been doing for the last few years.
And then... do you want to tell us about, like, if you were starting out with a farmer's market, or, like, maybe some success tips for people, like, for a farmer's market or for a CSA?
Absolutely. There's a lot of tips I would give. And I don't know if I could do it in less than 5 minutes, so... But, you know, generally, you know, whenever you're starting out, especially if you're going to, you know, try to make your garden or farm be a business that's self-sustaining, you know, try to think it through from now until the end. So try to visualize, you know, where the money's going to come at the end of the year. And to do that, you know, you want to, first of all, make sure that before, if you can, before you plant any seeds, is to have an idea where that product is, you know, whatever that seed is going to grow into is going to get sold to. And that means kind of researching some markets and, you know, with a CSA or farmer's market, you have a sense of it, but you can go knock on the back of restaurant doors and food stores and ask them what they might be looking for, how much they would take a week, how much they would pay, and start this kind of informal relationship of trying to get, you know, a sense of what, the market will bear, and, you know, would they buy from you if you brought in, you know, a case of lettuce or a bag of carrots that, you know, is of good quality for the going rate. And so if they are, you know, and I also always say, you know, I always ask, you know, are you getting it from any other local grower? Because I don't want to compete with my other neighbors and local growers. I think, you know, we want to work together, not at odds to each other. So, but if they're getting it from someplace far away, that then I don't mind taking a piece of the marketing pie from that. So if you can develop this kind of even just a handshake relationship with a buyer, whether it's a chef or a produce manager, then you can, you know, just check in with them in the winter, check in with them again in the spring, and then check in 2 weeks before you have the product ready to sell. And then come in, you know, and, you know, just, it's basically marketing is a relationship. And if you can maintain a positive relationship with your customer or people that are buying your products, then it should be self-sustaining. And so once you make that first sale, you bring in that case of lettuce or the bag of carrots, and they look at it and they say it's good quality, price is agreeable, they make that sale, then it's a pivotal point that you can then say, great, yeah, it's your first sale. And then hopefully, as long as you don't do anything wrong, that they'll buy from you week after week as long as you have that product and year after year, with negotiation and review at the end of the year of what worked and what didn't. So marketing is a big part of making it all work. And the other big part of it is to, you know, after you assess what you have as available market to you and what you want to grow and if it will work or not. The other thing is just to make sure that if you're to take your top three or four sellers of your farm, make sure that they're paying for themselves, meaning that the amount of work you do and the amount of inputs that you're putting into that crop is less than the amount of sales that you're getting when you sell it. And it can be on the back of an envelope. It can be, you know, something very simple, but just, you know, you know, I do this in workshops, you know, these quick budgets where I'll say, okay, I give parameters of saying 2 feeder pigs, it costs $80 each, and they raise for 6 months, they eat so many pounds of feed at this price, and this is how much time it takes. You know, we figure that out and say, okay, is that going to work or not? And it just roughs out the finances so people can say, okay, I need to really focus on maintaining my feed costs, and I need to focus on, you know, being as efficient as possible in chores, and also getting this price per pound if I need to make it all pay. So, and you know, and it's not unfortunately, but you know, if you're a diversified farm, you're doing so many things that it's, you know, a lot of times you don't keep track of those things. But if you're just to target 2 or 3 or 4 things that you sell the most of, then you at least know where the big money filling up your checking account is, making sure it's not all leaking out at the same time.
Okay. And then that's what a lot of the worksheets in your book are.
Right. So the worksheets.
Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. The worksheets in my book, unfortunately, are a little mind-numbingly complicated because I had to be completely transparent to the reader. My own worksheets are much simpler, but there's a lot of fine print, and only, again, so people could see where I got all those numbers from. And they work great. You know, you just can download them, copy them, and then just, you know, enter your own prices and inputs. But you can also make them a lot simpler. But generally what I try to do is just to stress to folks to just spend a little time, again, working on your business and analyzing. You know, maybe it takes, sit down for an hour and say, okay, am I making money on this or not? And include their time, you know, or put some value on your time, because one thing I can guarantee you that we all have in common is that we only have 24 hours in a day, and some of those hours are needed for sleep, and some are eating, and some are for family. The point is that our work hours are limited. You know, you can work 16-hour days, you can do that for a while, but you can't do it for the rest of your life. And so, you know, just make sure that you're treating your time wisely and, you know, put a value on it, you know. I also say, folks, when they're trying to figure that out, it's like, well, what would you like to make an hour, you know, $15, $20 an hour, you know, something like that. And so use that number. Say, yeah, if I wasn't farming and I could be a, you know, waiter at a restaurant, or I could be a landscaper for $15 or $20 an hour, yeah, that's kind of a substitute wage. And so you can kind of get a sense of what that might be.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's important. And I think that people might be surprised if they looked at those numbers. Maybe something they didn't realize was making as much money might be something they want to focus on more, and that would help them bring in more money and give them more time with their family or doing the things that they really want to do, including just even having more time in your own garden to enjoy it.
That's right. Yeah,
I know. My podcasting friends talk about that a lot. They're always like, download this program that will record everywhere you've been for a week, and it'll tell you how much time you spend on Facebook and how much time you spend here and how much time you spend there, and then you can analyze your production. And so it's kind of like the same thing. They're like, I know it takes a long time, and, you know, some people will be like, you know, write down everything you're going to do for an hour, you know, by the 15-minute blocks or an hour block, you know, what you do for a week or 2 weeks, and then really in... I got to say, I haven't taken the time to do that, but I know people talk about that a lot, to be efficient and find out where you can find some extra time.
And I bet it's surprising about how much time we spend doing things we don't think we're doing that much of, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's on Facebook or, you know, shopping or whatever it might be.
And then, like I said, you know, sometimes you might be surprised at some crop that you didn't realize was making as much money is actually more profitable in the long run, and then you might want to expand that crop more.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if you're a diversified, you don't even have to be diversified. If you're a farmer doing more than one thing, and say you're doing 5 different things, I can guarantee you that the 5 things you're doing are not equally profitable. That, you know, that there's going to be they're going to be on a scale of good to not so good, or good to less than that. And so if, as long as you know that, once you can uncover that, then you can say, great, I'm going to emphasize this, or I'm going to try to raise the sales price or lower expenses on the lesser profitable ones. And, you know, it's, again, just shining a light on your business, so then you can be a better manager and, like you're saying, have more time and you know, just being a smarter farmer in the end, because you'll be able to have more time and not working as hard for it.
Mm-hmm. And then you also might see, like, if you have one customer that's buying a lot of one thing, like, especially, like, do you sell a lot of, like, greens and lettuces and things like that to restaurants, or is that kind of...
We used to. We used to do that more. We're not doing that anymore. We, again, like, our business has changed, so we're growing less variety and more of fewer things. So,
But I was just, I guess I was thinking along the thread of, you might find more customers. You might be like, wow, this person's really buying a lot of this. Maybe I should, you know, introduce this or suggest this to other customers that weren't buying it. Was, I guess, where I was going.
Sure. And I think the other thing is, I mean, with marketing, you know, if you're selling one thing, then you can hopefully laterally increase your product offering by offering them other things that you might be growing that they might be interested in. Yeah, marketing, you know, it can be fun. It can be sometimes frustrating. But I think, you know, you want to look at it as, again, a win-win situation. You know, if you have I'm a very cooperatively minded person, and, you know, I really think that our world will be a better place if we can have a food chain that isn't exploitive of one producer, you know, or of the producer, middle person, or the consumer, but a win-win situation that, you know, I can grow something at a fair price for me that you can still buy at a fair price to you. And that's the relationship. The same thing with any produce manager. You want to be on the same side and say, hey, let's talk about price. I need to make this. You need to sell it for that. How can we make this work? And once you have that relationship, that's a great thing to have.
I like that. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, my good friend, Dacia Daly from Simply Josephine.
It's all about handcrafted soaps and apron love here at Simply Josephine. Located in Montana's beautiful Tobacco Valley, I create everything from my home studio. Currently, I offer 6 different kinds of handmade soaps, 3 different salves, using wildcrafted plant medicine from right here in our beautiful valley. In addition to my body care products, I also make several styles of aprons. Everything is available at simplyjosephine.com. We want to share a little love with the Organic Gardener Podcast listeners. We're offering 15% off. Use code OGP15 at checkout. Thanks and have a beautiful day. simplyjosephine.com.
Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company.
We have a large variety of locally adapted, open-pollinated, non-GMO vegetable, flower, and herb seeds. And we hope you'll enjoy visiting our website, goodseedco.net or Good Seed Montana, and seeing the resources that we offer for becoming a better gardener, a better seed saver, and a member of building resiliency around food in your community.
And now we're going to get to the root of things with the rest of my interview with Richard Wiswall. What's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
That's a good one. I like it all. You know, I guess what I really like about my job is that it's the seasonal aspect of it is that I don't do one thing 365 days a year. Oh. And so, you know, in the spring, you're kind of, you know, dealing or, you know, you're busy preparing soil and making beds, and, you know, getting seeds in the ground. And then, you know, you're doing that kind of all year, but the bulk of it's happening in the early spring. And then, you know, then we have this kind of a wave of weeding in June and July, and then we're starting to harvest, and then we have a big harvest, you know, from August until we can't harvest any longer until, you know, November 1st or whenever it gets too cold. And so you're doing these things. And so by the time, you know, like sometimes, you know, after 10 weeks of doing seedlings, it's like, you know, it's okay to let seedlings go by. And then you're moving on to field crops. And then when field crops, you know, you're after a few months of that, you're harvesting them and then you're packing them out in the wintertime. It's a great kind of cycling of different tasks. And that's what I like them all. I wouldn't want to do one every day for the rest of my life, but I enjoy them all when they are in, you know, in their appropriate season.
How about on the flip side, is there an activity that you don't like that you got to kind of force yourself to get out there and do?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what those would be. I guess the least, one of the, my least favorite things to do is collecting money from people that don't pay up. And then also, and maybe dealing with conflict resolution with either accounts or, you know, people that work here. Those would probably be the things that, you know, just, you know, anytime you have a relationship, there's times that you have to work on it. And those are probably the harder, it's, the harder times. But, you know, I guess if it's, and if it's 20 degrees outside and blowing snow and you got to go pick kale, I guess that gets kind of old too.
Okay.
I mean, weather. I mean, we've slogged around in some pretty miserable times, you know, getting the truck stuck. And, you know, it's like you do it because that you have to.
Yeah. One of my guests down south said that the one she hated the most is having to go out and when it's super hot and the mosquitoes are out. So, yeah, yeah. Weather's a big, big
deal. Yeah, weather is it. Yeah. And you get that, you sign up for that. You know, I try not to complain about that because that's part of the game, you know, that I signed up for.
But that's good to share. Yeah. How about, what's the best gardening advice you have ever received?
That things want to grow, that plants want to grow, and we just have to step out of the way sometimes. That, you know, it's a wonder that a seed contains all this genetic information for it to go from this minuscule seed into a fully developed plant that will then go through its life cycle and set another seed, but, you know, usually harvested before that. And that, you know, you have to not screw up because plants will grow, and just to, you know, and have that faith in that, you know, that that, you know, just plants are on your side, I guess.
Cool. I like that. What's your favorite tool? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, it'd probably be a shovel, but it's a tough one. I could have, if I thought about it, I could probably come up with more humorous answer to that. But something, for me, it would just be something very elemental for working with the soil.
Let's see. How about a favorite? Do you have a favorite recipe from the garden? If you don't, that's fine.
I don't. Yeah, no. That's a, it's like, it's kind of like saying, "What's your favorite dessert?" Well, that's like, there's too many of them.
How about an internet resource? Is there anywhere you go on the internet to?
Well, in Vermont, we're very lucky to have a guy named Vern Grubinger, who is the UVM, University of Vermont Extension specialist, and he does a listserv for all the professional growers in New England. And so basically that resource, you can ask any question and any number of growers will answer it. You can advertise things, you can be kept aware of the news. And so for us, that's like a huge resource, and I encourage other states to do that as well. And so then, but, you know, that same group, the University of Vermont Extension, has a group called the Vermont Veg and Berry Growers. And if they have a website with all of these fact sheets and information that, you know, if you Google Vermont veg and berry growers or vegetable and berry growers, it'll come up to a website. And it's just got tons of information. So that's probably the first place I go to when I'm looking for something.
Okay. And I'll put the link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
How about a favorite book besides your amazing Organic Farmer's Business Handbook?
Boy, there's a lot of books. I'm going to have to think about that one, too. Sorry.
That's all right. Well, you kind of talked about business advice for listeners. Did you have anything else there? I mean, we've talked about that quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, yeah. No, I guess, I'm, you know, I love to see more people you know, farming, making a living farming, that are, you know, happy in what they're doing and not overworking themselves and sacrificing other parts of their life to do it. And so, you know, ultimately, I think we can all, you know, if we all could, you know, state what we want in life, and then once you do that, then it's a lot easier to achieve it. And so I think sometimes just sitting down and thinking about what is it you're really looking to do or wanting to do, and then once you articulate that, and actually maybe writing it on paper to make it more real, that you can say, okay, this is what I want, and that's when you're going to be able to go get it. It's hard to achieve a goal if you don't know what the goal is. And so, and that's, you know, I think good advice for, you know, anybody, not just farmers. And I think the other thing I do with, or have, you know, recommend for folks to do is to, you know, if you're farming or doing a market garden already, is just to spend 5 minutes and write down your job likes and dislikes, just like you were asking me before. You know, what is it that you like about your farming or your job, and what is it you don't like? And acknowledge it, but then also obviously try to do the things you like doing, and maybe, you know, get someone else to do the things you don't like. If you don't like bookkeeping, or if you don't like sales, or if you don't like record keeping, get someone else to do it. You know, truth be told, I don't like record keeping as much as anybody else. It's just that I realize that I have to do it in order to make my business as well-tuned as it can be. And, you know, it's a necessary part of being in business. But it's not like I love to record keep. I don't think anybody does. But it's more of the fact that, yeah, this is part of the job description.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of running a business and thinking about life is, I'm a big goal setter. So I really like goals and having hard goals written down. And then I like that part about, you know, finding somebody else, because, you know, my guests have answered that in an assortment of ways. Tons of people have said, I hate weeding, and tons of people have said, weeding's my favorite thing. So you'd be surprised if you think you really don't like something, that there is somebody out there that maybe wants to help you do that piece, and they're really good at it. And like marketing, like tons of people like are afraid of social media marketing, and they really like their like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and they don't want to have any part of it. But then I think also sometimes when you start doing it, you realize it's actually can be quite fun. And so maybe you just need to find an easier way. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Tell people about coaching, because I think coaching is essential, and people don't value a coach, and you have coaching services. So I think you should tell us today about like what they could get, what it looks like, or just, I don't know.
Sure. So basically what I do is I work through a couple organizations here in Vermont where I will work with a farmer or a farm to kind of tune up their business or make a business plan, or, you know, go over with the farm, you know, what their goals are and how to achieve them. And, you know, I go in there, and even though I think because I'm a farmer, people maybe are more willing to listen, but I will give homework at the end of the 2 or 3 hour session. And, you know, it's not like they're going to fail or, you know, get reprimanded if they don't do their homework, but just that simple nudge of someone by someone like myself is all they need to make them do it. And in fact, I could use sometimes a nudge, because there's times that I procrastinate things that, you know, I can put off because it's not super urgent. But, you know, a lot of times the farmers that I work with have just been waiting for an excuse for someone to ask them to do it. And it's as simple as a request that all of a sudden they spend the hour that it takes them to do it. And then I can review it. And this coaching business goes, you know, back and forth, and we become great friends usually. And, you know, it's a confident relationship that we have. And, you know, it helps them just take time away from their workaday world to, again, look at their business and try to make to shine a light on what's really going on. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan. I think there's coaching, you know, in all different shapes and forms. You just have to look around for it in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And like, so back to my pocket, like I finally got an accountability partner in September. And it's just been huge. Both of us have seen just giant jumps in our podcast and things that we knew we needed to get done. But sometimes just talking it through with somebody really helps. And sometimes, you know, finding that right partner. And then also I'm taking this online class right now, and we're doing a lot of exactly the things you're doing. And it's really nice because it's not like an online class where you go at your own pace. We actually, like, there's a head teacher and there's a support group, and you have homework assignments each week. And one of our first assignments at the first week, or I think it was last week, we're in week three, almost starting week four now. Week two was setting your goals and writing them down on paper and figuring out what do you want for your business and where do you want it to go. And just, you know, as you write it down and have to get more specific, you can kind of really fine tune what do I really, really want it to be. And then the guy who's the head of my podcast group, he has this acronym for focus. He says, follow one course until success. He's always kind of on our cases. Of course, I'm like of the polish the shiny object syndrome, because I wouldn't even have a podcast if I hadn't been polishing that shiny object. So I don't know.
I think that's great advice, what you just said. And having a goal, and just, you know, once you articulate it and write it down, it makes you think about what it is you really want. And that's what you really want to do in life, is get what you want. I mean, it seems kind of simple, but it's not so easy to do.
And it's really, they talk a lot about find somebody who's done what you want to do before and get them to be your mentor or your coach. Like, yeah, there's no reason to constantly reinvent the wheel, and that having somebody there, and it's definitely been true for me that way, is having somebody to kind of walk me through the steps of my podcast. And now having my accountability partner, he's just a little bit ahead of me, but I help him too, I know, in a lot of ways. And we go to each other's websites, and we read each other's emails that we send out, even though we have two completely different businesses, but we're both podcasters. I just can't recommend enough to people, if they want help, to contact you.
Yeah, and I think in your case, you know, eventually, not eventually, but, you know, you'll be helping other people when they start up their podcast, because you'll have the experience to share with them. Mm-hmm.
I did actually just start teaching a podcasting course.
Oh, good.
I'm hoping I'm going to go through my community college eventually, so I'm kind of doing like a beta group right now. Okay, here's my final question. Ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
One change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Huge question, and I'll answer it in a different way. Sure. I mean, we have the global climate change, which is something that we have to address, but I don't want to talk about that. I'd rather say that my hopes lie in the fact that you have young and older people that want to make a living off of land on any scale. It could be from, you know, small acreage to bigger acreage, that you can, it's an incredibly strong economic engine if we can get a lot of people growing food on for themselves as a small family or, you know, single person unit, and generating money. And I think, you know, it's not that glamorous. It's not like IBM with, you know, 10,000 employees. But, you know, if you have 10,000 farmers all working towards, you know, producing food, it has the same effect. And it's a backbone of most local communities, of having, you know, a strong agricultural and prosperous agricultural community. And so that's where I really feel like, you know, and that'll solve a lot of the other problems in our world that we face today. But so I guess that's where I'm hoping that happens more. And I see a lot of interest with young people, and I think it's great. And I just hope that they I just wish them success, you know.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Well, I think it's such a fun thing to do, and gardening is the most popular pastime for a good reason, because it is like fun and satisfying, and there's no end to the learning curve, because you can always learn something new and highly creative. There's so many good things about gardening that that I encourage anybody to try it.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay, so I do have a big note at the bottom of my sheet that says, don't forget to mention Chelsea Green. Do you want to just give a quick plug for Chelsea Green?
Because sure.
I love Chelsea Green Publishing. And hopefully I'm going to get some of them to come on soon.
That'd be great. Chelsea Green Publishing is a great publisher. They're the one that published my book, but they're a Vermont company that walks the talk, that they publish books that are, you know, having to do with the kind of issues of today, these green sustainable issues that we have today, and they actually look for people to write books that address certain things, and they do a very good job. I had such a pleasant experience working with them as an author, as a first-time author, I can't say enough about their how nice it was to work with them. So Chelsea Green, you can go to their website, chelseagreen.com, and you'll read all about it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And they're like one of the few emails that like I read it whenever it comes. I subscribe to their, I just love their books. I have tons of their books and I just can't say enough about them. And that's how I found you, because I just, it came in one of the emails and said, check out this new book. And I bought it and have loved it.
Well, that's great. Good.
So tell everybody, how do they connect with you if they want to sign up for coaching or they want to see your website and they want to see those greenhouses or anything?
So you can go to katefarm.com. That's CateFarm.com. That has some, you know, just, it's a kind of informational kind of website and got some photo galleries. And then I also have a website called richardwiswall.com where it's more for the consulting and workshop end of my life. And so you can look at that as well.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for sharing with us today. I know listeners are going to love this episode.
Well, I'm happy to contribute. Good luck with your efforts here, Jackie.
Thanks. This is Jackie Marie Beyer, and I am just hoping that you're as excited to be learning and gardening this spring as I am. And so I'm really wondering what you're up to this spring. And I am super excited to announce that I am finally going to launch my Facebook group, the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group. So I really want to hear about your journey, and I really hope that you will come there and share your questions, your successes, your challenges, your pictures, your connect with the other listeners in the audience and, what's your vision for the future, or what's your vision for your garden, for your organic oasis? You know, are you planting flowers? What are you doing? You know, what project are you taking on this spring, this summer? You know, I really want to learn, what do you want to know? Is there, what kind of guests do you like? You know, who have you enjoyed? Who would you like to hear more of? You know, what topics are you really enjoying? You know, is it raising honeybees or planting perennials, or, what kind of seeds are you looking for? You know, are they annuals, perennials? You know, what kind of vegetables, what kind of herbs are you planting? What flowers? Do you have any questions that we can answer? You know, what guests have you liked the most? You know, so what is there something you want me to find out? Like, I'm really going to try to be as active in Facebook, the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook page and the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group. So, if you're interested in, learning more and reaching out and connecting with other people, especially, the great thing about it is all of a sudden, you might meet three people who are in your area. Just like since I started my podcast, I met Robin Kelson and Laura Behenna. So it was so fun to see them last week. And Pamela Lund, who, if you haven't heard her episode, she's just got a great story. Robin's been in the top 10 since she aired. But to meet these, people, and then I went to the Aero Conference and met more people that are living locally near me here in Montana that I never knew till I started my podcast. And so if you join the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook group, you'll probably meet people in your area. And then maybe I'll be able to find some people from the other states, because I think I'm up to like state 20 or 21 still. So there's still more states that I haven't interviewed people from than states that I have. One of these days I'm going to read that list and try to get some people, some listeners. Listeners always make great guests, I think. You've all got more knowledge than you think to share and some answer that somebody else has been looking for. So if you want to come on and share your gardening journey, I'm always looking. But today I really want to talk about, join our group, you know, let me know, what can I do for you? Even if you don't want to do the Facebook thing, I totally understand. Or if you have another channel that you like, you know, reach out to me, email me, go to the website. You know, you can connect with me. There's the Get in Touch page. There's a listener survey on there where you can, you know, which basically is just easy questions about, you know, what's your biggest challenge that I can help you with? But just most of all, I hope if you want to, you will come join the Facebook group, connect with me, and just let's change the world together. Thanks for listening. And remember to grow.